on the outline, on the back of the outline, there's a URL code for an article on the amorality of atheism, which I would commend to you on the Gospel Coalition to read up in more detail on this topic that we're dealing with here, about really why are atheists moral? 6 points I've got. One, the word moral, originally from the Latin, originally meant more, it wasn't a matter of right and wrong, it was more a cultural statement. Kind of like our English word, the mores of a group. What do we do around here? But the Judeo-Christian understanding down the centuries from there reshaped Latin, and so that the word itself becomes moral in the terms of right and wrong in some kind of absolute fashion. So originally, the mores of an Italian city would be different to the mores of a Greek city. But the morality is, it's a matter of right and wrong. Secondly, the history of atheism as an early critique of Enlightenment atheism, that'll help you with the titles, won't it? As an early critique of Enlightenment atheism, it was immorality. Especially because Enlightenment atheism came to the fore in Europe, and especially during the French Revolution, which ended in an appalling bloodbath, you may or may not remember. And so the very concept of atheism was connected with revolution and bloodshed at the same time. And so it became very important for atheists to distance themselves from immorality. And by arguing the point that you don't have to be religious to be moral, we're moral people, we're not like those revolutionaries, even though they share the same atheism we share, which leads to the third point, that becomes the polemic of atheism. I mean, the best defence is offence, is to go after the opponents. So it was important to show that religious people are in fact immoral and hypocrites. So it's not just that we atheists are moral, but actually these moralist religious people, they're really hypocrites, they're immoral. And while at the same time, the leading atheists had to conform to the kind of middle class morality of the day in order to gain a hearing. For if they were radical revolutionaries, well then they'd be written off as just excusing their kind of immorality. And so you'll never find anything critical, for example, of the life of Charles Darwin. They protected the life of Charles Darwin very carefully. He might have been a very moral, nice man, but it was really important that he was a very nice, moral man. Otherwise, the reason he's saying what he's saying, the rationalisation, has to do with his immorality. And so there's this polemic of atheism. However, the fourth point is, the rationality of atheism undid them. For the Enlightenment established that rationality is the sole basis for knowledge. We don't know anything from revelation. We know things only from science and rationality, empiricism and deduction. But there is no rational basis for morality. And over time, it became more and more clear. So Nietzsche is a good example of one who blew the whistle on the idea of rational morality and said, no, it's nonsense. You're just middle-class Englishmen and English women, blue stockings, they call them. And you're putting a gloss over it. In fact, there's no reason to be moral at all. But yet they were. And they were for another reason. That is, number five, it's God's world. So the language of the world is moralistic. Right, wrong, good, evil. It's very hard to talk about things, especially if you've got a radical view of life that needs changing society. Very hard to talk without talking about good and evil, right and wrong. So Mr. Dawkins, for example, and we'll give a quote later tonight, Mr. Dawkins says there's no such thing as good and evil. But yet, a few pages later, you'll find Mr. Dawkins saying that this is a terrible evil. The language captures us, but it's more than the language, it's the reality. The intuitive reality of atheists, the intuition is there are things that are evil. you can't really look at the gas chambers of Hitler and say, well, boys will be boys. I mean, it just is, it's just absurd. There is such a thing. And so they were undermined by the reality. And sixthly, I thought you'd like to see it in one man, Joel Marx, a professor of philosophy who was a great moralist, arguing against utilitarian amorality for Kantian morality for all his adult life, really, until he said, I was a moral fool. It's in a magazine called Philosophy Today. And he confessed he's a moral fool because he'd been converted. Not to Christianity, though. He said, my shocking epiphany is that religious fundamentalists are correct. Without God, there is no morality. Now, at that point, he had two options. Come to acknowledge God, or give up a morality. Well, of course, he gave up a morality. And so he doesn't believe there is such a thing as right and wrong. He locked himself up in his home for 12 months while he tried to work out how to live in a world that was not moral, because it doesn't make sense. So why are they moral? Well, the whole host of reasons, like with most of us, there's a whole host of reasons for why we do what we do, isn't there? But the atheists, they don't want morality, but they can't get away from it. They want to be totally rational, but there is no rational basis for it. There's the conundrum they are caught in, which is quite a severe conundrum. Now, I don't know what happens when I press this button next as to what you're going to see. Oh, I know. Tonight we're looking at Romans 3, 1 to 20, and we're looking at the subject of what's wrong with the world. You remember, we do see as our summary of Christianity a presentation called Two Ways to Live. And one of those parts of Two Ways to Live is this. You see, it says God is the ruler of the world, that's the big crown that over the world, but we all reject God as our ruler by running our own lives our own way. So we step aside from being under the crown of God and put the crown on our own head. But by rebelling against God's way, we damage ourselves, each other, and the world. Friends, during the course of this evening, we're going to be seeing that description of the reality of life, of what's wrong with the world. We'll come back to it in many different ways. But tonight what we're doing is showing that the Bible teaches this. It's up there, isn't it? Well, the Bible teaches this. Sorry, that screen's not working anymore. But the Bible is teaching this. Those of you who can't see, there is a back one for you to be able to see. And also, that our experience teaches us this. So we're dipping in and out of Romans, and we're dipping in and out of our own experiences of life to see that it's true. But let's start with praying for the world. So Tony is going to come and lead us in our prayer time. Well, first question for us to be talking with each other is, what do people do? You can put yourself in there if you like. What do you do? What do people do when they're caught or exposed in some moral failure? Start off thinking of the small child, but then move up to the politicians and other people, and then kind of wind up confessing to each other. What do people do when they're caught in some kind of criminal activity, some kind of wrongdoing, some moral failure? What are the reactions people have? Okay, there's no end to the answers here, so let's gather some quick answers from each other. Always good to have one person ready to speak up for the group.
They turn to moral relativism and compare themselves to others.
Turn to moral relativism and compare themselves to others, yes?
They find themselves a scapegoat.
They find themselves a scapegoat, yes?
They try and cover it off.
They try and cover it up, yes?
Deny it.
They just deny it, yes? Not me, I didn't do it.
They divide the blame around.
They divide the blame around, yes? It was my mother, she weaned me too quickly, yes?
They double down.
They double down, by which it means?
was my answer.
It was.
It was.
It's like when you say, yeah, I did it. I did it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you claim it. Yes, okay. Yes. That's one of the options.
They give an excuse.
They give an excuse, yes. They come late and eat, yes.
They try to justify it,
yes.
I believe there's three reactions.
Three reactions, good.
They either run.
They run.
Fight. Or be humble to it.
Run, fight, or be humble to it. Thank you.
They do an apology TikTok dance.
An apology TikTok dance. Would you just like to show us now so we can understand what it is, yes? Sorry?
In denial.
They're just in denial. Yes, that's all right. Okay, how are we going?
Blame it on their circumstance.
Blame it on their circumstance, yes.
I'm trying to think of one that hasn't already been said, but yeah, just try and justify it in some way.
Justify in some ways, yes?
Gaslight.
Sorry? They gaslight, yes. There's a new version, yes?
They might claim it's subjective.
They claim it's subjective, yes? They throw a tantrum, yes. You were thinking of the children, of course, rather than the politicians. No, you were thinking of the politicians, yes?
They refuse to back down.
They refuse to back down?
Ditto.
blame it on someone else.
Yeah, blame it on else. Someone else?
They give a false apology.
False apology, yeah, we're very good at that. I'm really sorry that you're offended by this. Yes.
They scapegoat.
They scapegoat it, yes.
Some people accept their guilt.
What kind of weirdo are you, Ethan? Was it your decision? Some people accept their guilt. Yes, they do. Yeah, that's right. It's one of the things they do. Mainly teasing you. Whoops, I'm standing on here. Oh, good, next.
Suicide?
Suicide, yes, they do that. That woman who jumped off the cliffs over Dover Heights when they found out she'd been cheating people their money, she appears, jumped off the cliffs, yes?
Challenging whether or not it's actually wrong.
Challenging whether or not it's actually wrong. So sometimes I can challenge, did I do it? Sometimes I can challenge, well, I did, but it's not really wrong, is it? Have we gone down here in the front? No.
Oh, they just beat up people.
They just beat up people, yes. Sorry?
They just punch people in the face or something.
Just punch people in the face. Beat up people, yes. All kinds of options, aren't there? One of the ones you left out is they employ a lawyer. That's another option, isn't it? Right? I mean, there's any number of ways in which people avoid the accusation that they're guilty of. Last week at the end of chapter 2, we found the Jews were guilty of deep hypocrisy in their law ownership that they didn't keep. Chapter 3 of Romans starts off on that topic, but why don't we hear about it from... We finish on verse 9. We come to this great conclusion, which is what we're looking at tonight. That is, see there, verse 9, we're all under sin. See, that's what our presentation of the message of Christianity is saying. We all reject God as our ruler by running our own lives our own way. That's what we mean by this word sin. But by rebelling against God's laws, we damage ourselves, we damage each other, and we damage the world. So the problems that you see in the world in terms of our damaging of ourselves, of damaging each other and of damaging the whole world itself and its environment, it all comes from our rejection of God and our establishment of ourselves as autonomous, as independent. And so that's why we're looking tonight at, is that what the Bible teaches? And is that what we see in the world? And do the two things match up, you see? Well, it's certainly what the Bible teaches, because it's not only Romans 1 to 8 or that verse 9. Verse 9 is then explained and shown to be the whole Bible's teaching, which Sarah is going to show us now, by reading all these verses from the Old Testament, which in verses 10 to 8 show that it's all over the Old Testament that we're going to read. So just picking up verse 10 following. I mean, it's really reinforced there, isn't it? There is none that does. No one. No one. No what? Not one. No. All. it's pretty hard to be more emphatic on the idea that we all reject God. That everybody is, I mean, it's the power of the negative. You can say all, and that just means the whole lot. But when you say, no, not one, you're making it absolutely clear. The Bible's teaching, in many places in the Old Testament, is that we are all, every one of us, individually, under sin. That's where we are. And so it's that verse, we're all under sin, that we're going to be looking at through the night as we get there. But that's looking at the Bible. What are the alternative explanations for the problems of the world? For what's wrong with the world? So here's the question for you to be discussing with each other. What alternatives are common explanations for the question, what's wrong with the world? Don't have to be yours, but the common ones that you hear or that you have heard. What are the common alternative explanations? You'll see where we're up to in the outline now as we're at the top of the right-hand page, aren't we? I'll collect up a few minutes' time these common ones. Okay, I'm sure you've come up with some answers. Let's hear what the other groups have been thinking. We'll head in their opposite direction.
We had a general theme of valuing ourselves to the expense of other things.
We value ourselves to the expense of other things. Other people, other things, yes. What do we think, James? James, you? Huh? James.
What do we think?
We don't know what we said. It is the problem of the world is we're forgetful.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. That's an explanation that people give, yes.
That's conflict, war, murder, all that stuff.
Yeah, what's the explanation?
Video games.
Sorry?
Video games.
Video games, yes, yes. Little bit of personal testimony there from Mr. Norved, yes.
Political and economic imbalance.
Political, economic imbalance, yes.
Patriarchy.
The patriarchy, yes.
People.
People, that's the problem with the world. Did away with people, we'd be happy.
You can argue there's nothing wrong with the world.
There's nothing wrong with the world, that's right.
The education system.
The education system, that's in the Department of New South Wales education, of course. Yes, what about out here?
Corruption.
Corruption, yes. Just people are corrupt, yes.
People are really judgmental.
People are judgmental, yes. So there's nothing really wrong with the world other than the judgmentalism of other people causing problems, yes? How about we're going here?
Racism.
Racism is a big problem around the world.
I'm not in charge.
You're in charge, are you?
Not in charge.
Oh, you're not in charge. Okay, so what's the answer? Because he's not in charge.
Well, that's what people say.
Yeah, okay, that's what people say.
Institutions.
Sorry?
Institutions.
The institutions cause the problem, yes? Thank you very much. We'll come to Mr. Rousseau.
Colonisers,
yes, they're the problems, aren't they? If we hadn't had colonisation, we'd all be happy, noble savages, yes?
Rich people.
Rich people are the problem, yes? Isn't that true? Because none of us are rich, are we? So it's other people's problems, yes?
Lack of knowledge.
Okay, I don't know about that answer, but no. Good. Next.
Overpopulation.
Good. My brother has 26 grandchildren. Do you think he's the problem, huh?
We said Mercury is in retrograde.
Mercury is in?
Retrograde.
Thank you. Here we go. People do say these things, so that's all right.
We
say religion or gods are the problem. Yes, thank you. They often say that. Look at the comments columns of the Sydney Morning Herald that said every day.
Greed,
yes, that's the problem. Yes.
Taylor Swift
is the problem. Whoops. Yes.
Rich and powerful people.
Rich and powerful people.
Propaganda
is the problem, yes?
Authority.
Authority is the problem in general, yes?
Big pharma.
Technology.
Technology.
Other generations.
Sorry?
Other generations.
Other generations, yes. Hang on, other generations than mine.
Yeah, then the one.
Like the younger generations.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Good. Just want to be clear. We've been here, haven't we? Yes, I thought you might have a second, yes?
Individualism?
Individualism is a problem, yes? How are we going?
Old white men.
Old white men. Old fat white men, in particular.
It's yes. Okay, you don't have to identify.
No, I don't identify. Had this woman come to me one day and said, the problem is, Philip, we've got too many old fat white men like you. So I said to her, can't do much about it. I can go on a diet. But I'm not going to change either way, yeah?
Climate change.
Climate change. Okay, did I miss any group in the process? Yes, okay. Lots of alternative reasons that people give. Whew. Here is Professor Steven Pinker, an international... With hair like that, you should be a professor, shouldn't you? A psychologist, but an international speaker and intellectual of today. And he said, as a young teenager in proudly peaceable Canada during the romantic 1960s, I was a true believer in Bakunin's anarchism. Come back to that. I laughed at my parents' arguments that if the government ever laid down its arms, all hell would break loose. And notice in that word anarchism is the word archaich. That's the Greek word for authority, for ruler, right? Anarchism is the rejection of all rulers. If we had got rid of all authorities, all rulers, all arches, patriarchy, see, patriarchy, that little arch word, that's always about ruling. Get rid of all rulers, the world would be a much happier place. Mikhail Bakunin was a revolutionary anarchist of Russia, 1814 to 1876, the organization of society on the basis of voluntary cooperation without political institutions or hierarchical government. That's what anarchy means. His famous quote is, "The passion for destruction is also a creative passion." He was a good friend of Marx until he worked out that Marx was too wet and soft and woke. So, our friend, the professor, was a true believer in Bakunin's anarchism. But this is a conversion story, this one. You see, our competing predictions, my parents and mine, were put to the test at 8 a.m. on October the 17th, 1969, when the Montreal police went on strike. What happens when the police in a city like Montreal go on strike? Well, by 11:20, the first bank was robbed. By noon, most downtown stores had closed because of looting. Within a few hours, taxi drivers had burned down the limousine competitor's garage. A rooftop sniper killed a police officer. Rioters broke out into several hotels. A doctor slew a burglar in his home. By the end of the day, 6 banks had been robbed, 100 shops had been looted, 12 fires had been set, carloads of storefront glass broken, $3 million in property damage before the city authorities had to call in the army and, of course, Canada, the Mounties, in order to restore order. It wasn't just the police now, you had to get the army to regain the city. Within one day, within less than a day, less than 24 hours, the place had gone to complete chaos. And so Mr. Pinker, Professor Pinker, says, the decisive empirical test left my politics in tatters. And so he's moved and changed his political views on life, become much more conservative as a result. I'm not pushing for conservatism. He didn't become a Christian. So the conversion, though, was away from the idea there's nothing wrong with the world other than the ruling. If we got just rid of rulers, got rid of all authorities, got rid of police, got rid of anybody having any authority over everybody else, we'd quickly have a paradise for us all. Well, here's the occasion when it happened. And one man had enough brains to see it doesn't work. But others don't see it. Rutger Bregman is an international bestseller. He's written this book, Humankind, A Hopeful History. It's a really runaway bestseller. It's been out about 2-3 years now, something like that. But it's been on the New York bestseller list for ages. I subscribe to a medical magazine. Don't ask me why. It's a long, complicated story, but I do. In it, they rarely give book reviews, but they book reviewed this book. Well, they didn't book review it. They just said it was the most magnificent thing that they'd ever seen. You know, Stephen Fry says, hugely, highly, happily recommended. It's a book that just captures so much of today's hopes and aspirations that humans, he says, actually are kind, and therefore our history for the future is very hopeful. What he does is he compares or contrasts two Enlightenment thinkers, Jacques-Jean Rousseau and Thomas Hobbes. Quite a contrast in physical appearance, according to the artists, aren't they? They're interesting portraits, but what's the difference between them? Well, one of them says the condition of man is a condition of war, of everyone against everyone. The other one says people in their natural state are basically good, but this natural innocence, however, is corrupted by the evils of society. Which is which? Hands up those who think Rousseau is the first one. Heads up, they think Rousseau is the second one? Yes, well, you're right, he's the second one, and Hobbes is the first one. See? Hobbes, well, just look at the portrait of the two men. Who's the happy man and who's the unhappy one? Right? One man sees the world is beautiful and people are marvellous and magnificent and just really good, but institutions are stopping them and society is holding us back from the goodness. You see, you're still back in anarchy. If we just get rid of institutions, get rid of organisations, get rid of rulers, get rid of authorities, just let people be themselves, well then utopia would arrive. Mr. Hobbes, what we need is strong central government that keeps people in their place, because people are fundamentally bad. And if you don't have government keeping them in place, they'll do a Montreal. 150 years before Montreal, so I don't think he actually used that illustration. So, there's the two that Bregman contrasts throughout his book. He gives a famous illustration. Take William Golding's The Lord of the Flies. Hands up those who have not read The Lord of the Flies or heard of it. You know the story. A bunch of little English primary school boys get shipwrecked while the plane crashes, and so they wind up on an island, and there they set up a society which is just so hostile to each other and destructive, and it just shows what little English schoolboys are really like. He contrasts that with the real life event that happened in the late 50s, 60s of this group of Tongan fellows who, on a lark, got a boat. They were boarders at a school, and they got in a boat. A storm came up and blew them away from Tonga onto an island, and they were considered lost at sea, but they survived 15 months on a desert island, which was not desert, it was well vegetated, being that part of the world. And so they lived for 15 months until they were extraordinarily saved by an Australian, of all people. And the... Yeah, I thought it was funny. The 15 months, they created an ideal society, working together happily and harmoniously, you see. And so he says, Lord of the Flies, well, that's Hobbes. But it's a fiction. It's not true. Everybody believes it, but it's just a fiction. It's a story. Whereas the real life event of our boys from Tonga, well, that's what you'd expect from Mr. Rousseau. That given their opportunity, they would all live harmoniously and happily together. Because it's nonsense. Yes, it is a fiction, but it's a fiction about English primary school boys, whereas the Tongan boys were teenagers from 13 to 19. The boys, the English school boys, didn't know each other until they wound up on the island with each other, whereas the Tongan boys all went to the same school, they were all on the same lark, they were working together from before they ever went to the island. In fact, they all were in the same Christian school, and what they did was in the boat they prayed, and what they did on the island was pray every morning. They already had a system and an institution worked out as to how to live and how, and they set up one, two of the eldest two boys, in control and authority over the other. So they set up a society under authority and archy, just like they had learnt to do from their Christian background and Furthermore, English schoolboys don't live very well on an island, but Tongans, well, they come from an island. They know how to catch fish and to catch birds and to live in that kind of environment. It wasn't super clever of them. Well, it was. They survived. But, you know, it was not quite... The comparison's not a comparison. It's really a silly comparison. But here is the story. And the way in which you persuade people today is tell stories, which is get rid of rationality. Now, there's lots of rationality in Mr. Bregman's book, and I'd commend it to you. It's an interesting read. It just doesn't address the issue. It doesn't address the issue of why all over the world, all down the centuries, people have practiced slavery until 200 years ago. In every society, everywhere. Even today, we don't call it quite slavery in Dubai, but that's what it is. And why down the centuries and all over the world in every culture have we seen women oppressed? And polygamy practiced to the disadvantage of women and to the disadvantage of beta males. Why has that been the universal practice around the world except where Christianity has come? And why, I mean, he just doesn't address the issues of the realities of the sufferings of this world. It's sad, but the trouble is it says what the Rousseauan Enlightenment people want to hear. We are basically good. It's just the system's against us. But you don't necessarily say that. You see, Dawkins, he puts it the other way. What are the answers you gave? The universe we observe is precisely the properties we should expect, is if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. There's nothing wrong with the world. Because there is no good, there is no wrong, there is no evil, there is no bad. This is just the way it is. Very hard to say that to someone whose mother has just been murdered, whose brother has just been murdered. It's very hard to say that in the context of domestic violence. It's very hard to say that in Gaza today. Hey, it just is. It's the way it is. You know, people have always been dropping bombs at each other. It's a sport. You know, some people do it on Saturdays, on Sunday. I mean, it's a nonsense, which he himself doesn't uphold because he keeps on saying religion is an evil, which is kind of funny, seeing he's come to the conclusion there is no evil. But you see it with Professor Jesse Prince. He says no amount of reasoning can engender a moral value because all values at bottom are emotional attitudes. The judgment that something is morally wrong is an emotional response. See, I have this emotional response when I hear that Pol Pot killed a third of the population of Kampuchea in just a couple of years. I have an emotional response that says, that's bad. But hey, just shows that Phillip's a distorted emotional person, isn't it? I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing that. I mean, he left two-thirds of the population. You know, how many Kampucheans do you want? You know, what's your problem? About two-thirds, yeah. What's your problem? Well, I'm sorry, I want to say it's bad, and I want to say it's more than just I have an emotion on the subject. I want to say that's wrong. That has to be stopped. But of course, Pol Pot learnt his philosophy from the existentialist atheists of Paris, where he went for his postgraduate studies under the Marxism of the 1950s, 60s French existentialism, where there is no right, there is no wrong, there is just authentic self. And his authentic self meant murder of millions of people. Now, pick Pol Pot, yeah. List the other ones. The list goes on and on of these people who do this. Are you really going to just say it's just emotions? See, the alternatives to what's wrong with the world that we shared around ourselves, yes, they're the alternatives people give. But which one do you really want to hang your hat on? Because, frankly, the alternatives don't do justice to what's wrong with the world. They don't do justice to the significance of humans. They don't do justice to justice in the end. But as soon as you have justice, You've got to have somebody outside the world to give it to you. And so here's the moral fool. I can't have morality without God, so I'll do without morality. That's a dreadful answer. It's a much easier one. Much easier. Well, after the break, we'll hear more about what it is that we're coming to, but I can see someone's arranging. Come, talk to us, brother. Tell us what is. Okay, as I said, we're not going to spend much time on these, so what evidence do you have that all are sinful?
Children, which sounds a bit cynical, but like just how children behave.
How children behave. And you're not a father?
No.
Really? That's a very wise man, that one. If you're a father, you'd know it, yes? You never have to teach children to tell lies. They just know. One of my daughters, the first full sentence she said was a lie.
You were saying, like, because different people have different ideas of what's good. Yeah, so if sin's universal, it makes sense that we don't agree on actually what's good.
We don't even agree on what it is, yes?
Oh, death.
Death is everywhere, yes?
We have locks on our cars.
We have locks on our cars, yes? That's clear.
I said children.
Children again, yes?
Had a good one.
No one questions there's something wrong with the world?
No one questioned that there was something wrong with the world. Well, some people did say it's all right.
True.
But yes, you're right, yes? Elijah?
We're all ungrateful even in a privileged country.
We're all ungrateful even in a privileged country. And when we got thanked, we thank our lucky stars because we don't know who else. I don't know who lucky star is, really. Used to be a rock singer. Mm-hmm.
You lock up the door to your house.
You lock up the door to your house, yes?
But bad things happen everywhere.
Bad things happen everywhere, yes?
I was saying, referring to Romans 2, that God has written the law on people's hearts, and everyone knows what is right, and right was...
Yes, the intuition, which Romans 2 talks about, being written on our hearts, yes?
Everyone's lied.
Sorry, everyone tells lies. Is that a truth or is that a lie?
I don't know.
If I only tell lies all the time, have I just told you the truth or have I told you a lie? Just thought I'd give you a mathematical problem. Yes?
We also said kids.
Kids. I said you guys are really against kids, aren't you? Can I encourage you that having children is great fun and get married and have them. It really is good. I commend it to you warmly. The only thing better than having kids is having grandkids. With a particular exception I won't mention. So, yeah. We all lock up our cars. I mean, the interesting one that you haven't said is passwords. Why do you need passwords on every electronic gizmo you've got? It's because you just can't trust people, can you? Huh? Because people everywhere doing. But kids are classic. Yeah, I tell you the truth, one of my children, the very first sentence they said was a lie. Absolute lie. She said, when challenged for having done something wrong, wrecked a television, she said, my brother, Matthew, did it. Matthew had been in school for about 6 hours at that stage, and there was no chance that he had done it. But that was her first full sentence. Matthew did it. No wonder I have the grandchildren I have. Now, yeah, so all, that's the first thing. But the next thing is, all are under sin. See, sin is being personified here, if you know that link, that language system. It's being personified. Paul does that from time to time. So, for example, in chapter 5, sin reigned in death. Or chapter 6, the wages sin pays. Or over in Galatians, scripture imprisoned all under sin. Sin is personified in this passage as a power that rules over us. It's like a powerful addiction that works against our best interests. It's bad. We don't want to do it, but we do. the good that we want to do, we don't do. There's something wrong with us. If I don't do the good things I want to do and I do the bad things I don't want to do. I don't want to tell lies, so why have I told lies? I want to tell the truth, so why don't I always tell the truth? There's something corrupted about me at this point. And it's an addiction. Once you start down the track of the substance abuse or the behavioural abuse, once you start down the track, it reinforces itself over and over and over. And I feel bad about myself, and the way I feel good is by doing it again. So I do it again. Be it alcohol, be it pornography, be it whatever it may be. It's the same kind of thing with addictions. And sin is like an addiction. Now remember, in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, the first vital step of the 12 steps is we admitted that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. As long as an alcoholic refuses step one, the alcoholic will never get out of alcoholism. The very first step is to acknowledge the problem. If they won't acknowledge the problem, you're wasting your time talking to them because they'll keep drinking until they are in the gutter, and one day, hopefully, they'll recognise their life had become unmanageable and come back to AA. But that's exactly the same with sin. As long as you think you're not a sinner, you've got no chance of overcoming the problem. That's the truth with any addict that you might have. As long as you can, look, I can give up cigarettes if I want to. Well, you can't, basically. See, Jesus said, I wanted Jesus. What happened to Jesus?
He died and rose again.
Yeah, and rose again. Jesus answered them and said, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. That's the truth will set you free. It's that passage, Mark, John chapter 8. The truth that he's talking about, the freedom that he's talking about when he says the truth will set you free, is freedom from the slavery to sin. That's the truth. That's the freedom that he is talking about and offering. Okay, here's your next question. Where do you see such slavery in the world? In our society, in ourselves. Do you think you mentioned that third one to each other? Anyway, where do you see slavery to sin in the world, or in Australia, or in ourselves? Just a couple of minutes, be quick about it. Okay, let's start up the back this time. Where do we see such slavery in the world?
Pornography,
yes.
Individualism.
Money, yes. The love of money, it's terrible, isn't it? Yes.
Gambling.
Gambling's a terrific problem, isn't it, in Australia? And of course, the slavery of gambling is not just the individuals who are enslaved. Our governments are enslaved to the gambling industry because 15% of Victoria's revenue comes from gambling. So the Victorian government can't afford to get rid of gambling. It's addicted to gambling. In fact, our society is. It's a terrible addiction, yes?
Power.
Sorry?
Power.
Power? Yeah. Yes, people love power. They want power. They're poor politicians, they think they've got some. Yeah?
Alcohol.
Alcohol, yeah. It's a massive problem in Australia, is the alcohol addiction. I keep mentioning to you the number of children who have fetal alcohol syndrome, whose whole lives are destroyed by alcohol. And the alcohol industry doesn't pay for it, yes?
Debt,
yes, it's a terrible thing to be caught in debt. Okay, what about in Australia? Well, these are in Australia. What about in ourselves?
Needing to, like, work all the time.
Yes, the need to work all the time, yes. Workaholics.
Self-righteousness.
Self-righteousness, yes. For some of us, that's easier than others, yes.
Or just selfishness.
Selfishness, yes. It's just so clear, isn't it, yes?
Being a people pleaser.
Being a people pleaser, yes.
Laziness.
Sorry?
Laziness.
Laziness, yes.
Lust.
Lust.
Pride.
Oh, hang on, you'll have something, won't you?
Thanks, Philip. Being very easily irritated rather than...
Easily irritated, yes, thank you, yes.
Religious rather than righteous.
Religious?
Rather than righteous.
Rather than righteous, yes. Yep.
Other people's opinions of ourselves?
Other people's opinions, yes. Wanting other people's opinions all the time.
Slave to having a good time?
To having a good time. Hedonism, yes. It's a real problem in Australia.
The need to fit in.
The need to fit in. Conformity, yes. We want individualism, but we want to be conformists at the same time. So we're all going to wear our own authentic clothes like everybody else, yes?
Addiction.
Addiction, yes. Any addiction, is it? Yes.
Social media.
Social media.
Materialism.
Materialism.
He stole mine.
Sorry?
He stole mine.
Theft. Yes.
The way that we treat relationships transactional.
Transactional relationship. It goes on, doesn't it? It goes on. We're caught up in it ourselves. All right? Okay. The Apostle John says, if we say we have no sin, well, we deceive ourselves. Truth is not in us. Very important truth, that one, isn't it? Because our society went, well, there's no such thing as sin, you know, and I don't sin. I met a man once, I asked the church to put up their hands if anybody had never told a lie. None of them did, so I said, put up your hand if you have told a lie. Everybody did. So I said, okay, I'm in a church full of liars. On the way out from the church, this man pulled him to a very big, huffy Englishman. He said, I have told lies, but I want you to know I'm not a liar. You ponder that for a while. What is a liar if it's not someone who tells lies? And if you tell lies, you're a liar. But somehow you wanted to say, no, it's not me. I don't... Of course it is you. If you've told lies, you're a liar. You don't have to keep telling lies every moment of every day to qualify in the category called liar. You just have to be you, that's all. So what we have here is all are under sin. But there's something else to be said about it. That is, it's all under sin. So the next point, where we're up to on our lightens, yeah, we'll go over the back page now, is sin. And two points to notice about it. One, it's singular, and two, it's God-oriented. See, it's singular, not plural. Professor Cranfield, a professor of the New Testament up in Durham University, he died at age 99 the other day. Paul, when he uses sin, thinks rather of sin as a power controlling man than of the individual sins which man commits. See, sin is the disease of which our sins are symptoms. We do the wrong things because we have the disease. And so Paul is talking about the sin, not the sins at this point. We're not under sins, we're under sin, the disease itself, which gives rise and explains the sins that we have. The reason we tell lies, the reason we have lust, the reasons we cheat, the reasons why we are greedy, the reasons why we're jealous of each other or envious of each other, all the different sins is because at heart we are sinful. At heart we have this disease. But this disease of sin is God-oriented. That it's not just horizontal and personal, it's also vertical towards God. See, the symptoms tend to be horizontal. We hurt other people. We use other people. We abuse people. We mistreat people. We lie to each other. It's horizontal even in the sense of we destroy the environment in which we live. But it can be vertical. You know, we curse God, we shake our fists at God, but that's unusual. It's vertical in that it's the disease is fundamentally vertical. The symptoms tend to be horizontal in this world, but the disease tends to be very vertical. It's our rebellion against God. Let's just pick it up in a couple of places. Verse 10, Sarah, can you read to us Psalm 14? Psalm 14 verses 2 and 3, Sarah, I've lost track of. Psalm 14 verses 2 and 3, and then Rosie will read to us Psalm 36 verses 1 to 3, Psalm 36, 1 to 3. Is that right? 14, yes, just stand up where you are and read loud, the voice, you can carry it off.
The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one.
Yes. Now, Psalm, what's verse 1 say?
The fool says in his heart, there is no God.
The fool says in his heart, there is no God. That is the premise upon which you see. You start off saying there's no God, you become corrupt in your heart. The fundamental of your life is a lie. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. You start off with a lie, you're not going to build the truth. You can't build the truth out of a lie. If the basis of your life is there is no God, well then, what truth are you going to build on that? It's the same kind of thing in Psalm 36, Rosie, verses 1 to 3.
Transgression speaks to the wicked deep in his heart. There is no fear of God before his eyes, for he flatters himself in his own eyes, that his iniquity cannot be found out and hated. The words of his mouth are trouble and deceit. He has ceased to act wisely and do good.
We deceive ourselves that our sin cannot be found out. Don't we all do that? Haven't we all got things right now that we wouldn't want the other people in this room to know about what we've done? We think if it's covered, then it's covered. Nothing's covered in front of God. It will all come out. But notice what the problem is there. There's no fear of God before them. Look back at Romans chapter 3 and the verses, the psalms that are all quoted there, and you'll see verse 10 is that Psalm 14 that Sarah read to us. And verse 18, the last of them, is Psalm 36 that Rosie's just read to us. Right? But we've all turned away from God. We have no fear of God. It's very sad. But do you remember the atheist that we saw earlier? No amount of reasoning can engender a moral value, because all values are at bottom emotional attitudes. The judgment of something is morally wrong. It's an emotional experience. But this man knows better than that. He understands what objective morality requires. For he wrote, objective morality requires a benevolent God, a human nature of innate sense of moral values, and rational principles like logic and arithmetic. But he can't face that as a possibility, so he just wants to say, look, it's just about our emotions, because he doesn't believe in a benevolent God, and therefore he doesn't believe in human nature, and therefore he doesn't in the end believe in rational principles. Everything's emotions. Here's one of the world's leading professors of psychology. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. It's a terrible thing, isn't it? The lengths people go to avoid the moral consequences, to be able to say, I'm not sinful. See, all the arguments of chapters 1 to 3 are leading up to the conclusion of verses 19 and 20. And the resolution of verses 21 through to 31, which we look at next week. How can we have justice and mercy at the same time? Well, don't miss that, because that's the most important. The whole of what we've been doing so far is heading up to that. But the conclusion we're heading up to tonight is verse 19. Now, we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. So we come to the last of the headings on the outline there, the law. Remember, the Jews felt morally superior because, unlike the barbarians, the savages, unlike the Greeks in their philosophical dead ends, they had the very oracles of God. They had the law. They had the word of God. They knew right from wrong, told to them by God himself. And he is right. The law does matter. The Jew does know more. But of course, what was important about the law is not that you had a copy of it, but that you did it. That's the key thing of chapter 2. holding a copy of it and not doing it, well, you needn't hold a copy of it. In fact, you're more hypocritical than ever, teaching it to others than you don't keep it yourself. And if the Jew can't be right with God, well, what chance is the savage? What chance is the Greek? What chance is the Gentile? Then nobody has a chance. Now, we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, the Jew. So that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world accountable to God. Because if the Jew can't serve God, the Jew who's been given the law of God, who owns the law of God, who reads the law of God, who's God's chosen people, if they can't, then nobody can be in. So the whole world's accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being, we're back to all, will be justified in his sight. Since through the law comes the knowledge of sin. And so here we come up to the end of what we're talking about today. You see, the contrast between what the law does and what the law does not. What does the law do? Well, it identifies sin and educates about sin. So if you didn't have the law, how would you know that coveting was wrong? If you didn't have the law, how would you know that bearing false witness is wrong? Intuition may give it to you, but how do I know what it means to love my neighbour if I haven't got the law telling me you shall not commit adultery? You see, the law identifies sin, educates about sin, and it condemns sinners. Because if you do not keep this, then you're under the judgment of God. That's what the law does. What the law doesn't do is cure sin or sinners. Doesn't. You can read the law every day of the week. But if you've broken the law, then there's no reading it tomorrow is not going to help you. It doesn't cure you. See, it doesn't change sinners. It may educate them. They might know better about their sin. What the law does, it fails to forgive sinners. It condemns sinners. So having the law, which is a wonderful thing, I mean, they're ahead of everybody else because they got the law, doesn't actually help. Now, let me make it a little bit clearer for you. See, what the law does is it identifies our sin. What it does is it educates us about our sin. What it does is it condemns us sinners. No point talking about them out there because it's us here. It's you and me. It all includes us, doesn't it? We are part of the all. And so what the law does is it condemns us. What the law doesn't do is cure our sin or cure us as sinners. What the law doesn't do is change us sinners into being anything different. Therefore, what the law doesn't do doesn't forgive us sinners, just condemns us. See, one of the ways our society thinks they're going to fix up society is by making more laws. The government's endlessly making laws, and society is never improved. Laws themselves don't change people. They condemn, they identify what's wrong, they find you are wrong, it condemns you, you have to pay the fine or go to prison. But it doesn't change you. We have more people in prison than ever. It's not surprising, we've got a bigger population than ever. But, you know, we're not reducing the numbers in prison, we're increasing the numbers in prison because we've got more laws, that's why. You have all the laws in the world against racism. Doesn't change racist. Racism is in the heart. Legislation about racism doesn't change racists. Now, you can't get any more laws about racists than you've got in the United States of America. But then, makes no difference. So, what hope is there? What hope is there for us? What hope is there for you? See, we want justice, but we need mercy. But how can you have both those at the same time? If God is just, he must punish us. If God is merciful, well, he's not just and we don't have justice anymore. So how can you have justice and mercy? Because we want both. And if we've only got the law, we've only got justice. Don't miss next week's exciting episode when we come to the topic of how we can have justice and mercy. But time's against us now, and I planned it that way. So let's take a moment on our outline you'll see to reflect for just a key moment on our key take-home message for tonight. And then we'll have a few questions just about this passage. If you've got other questions of any kind, well, you've got the QR code by which you can be asking questions. Is that right? But next week, how can we have justice and mercy? And whatever questions you want to ask. Take a moment to think about, write down, helps you clarify your mind to write.